Hi, Arash. How are you?
Fine, thanks for having me.
No, thanks.
A second time.
Thanks for taking the time. Yes, you did an earlier one with someone other than me on Blogging Heads.
Exactly.
That was unfortunately abbreviated by technical problems, but so we're gonna try to have a slightly longer conversation this time. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV, and you're Arash Malavi Vasay. That is
yes.
That is the way an American would mispronounce it, right? That's the correct American
exactly.
mispronunciation
yes, yes.
of your name. And you are an economist at the University of Hohenheim in Stuttgart, Germany. And Germany
exactly.
is at the epicenter of this Euro crisis. Now, I have the feeling, and you'll probably tell me this is wrong, that this crisis may finally be approaching some sort of climax. It seems like it's been going on forever, and larger economies have gotten sucked into it. It started with these small economies like the size of Greece facing a debt crisis. Now you've got Italy and Spain imperiled. And then earlier this week, your Chancellor Merkel, proposed a pretty dramatic, what she considers a solution. And then on Friday, European leaders are going to meet, and I guess she and Sarkozy of France will try to sell them on this solution, is my impression. And so there's the expectation mm-hmm. that some kind of big news could come one way or the other on Friday that could shake financial markets around the world. Wow, where to begin? First of all, let me throw out my understanding of what she proposed. She proposed to subordinate national fiscal policy to centralized European oversight. So
yes.
so that nations, if they didn't, European nations, at least those in the Eurozone with the euro currency,
mm-hmm.
if they didn't keep their budget deficit under 3%, they would face penalties or something.
Exactly.
And then the other, I guess implicitly, there's another part of that deal, which is that if she could kind of sell Europe on that, I guess she thinks then she would have enough political support to get for the European Central Bank to take a much more aggressive policy in fighting this in the near term. Is that right?
Yeah, it seems so. Like the president of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, signaled that if we have strict fiscal consolidation in Europe, the Merkel plan or Merkel-Sarkozy plan, then he is willing to be more aggressive.
Uh-huh.
So you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. And first of all, what do you think of the plan? But before we talk about whether it's likely to actually be realized. Tell me, what would the European Central Bank likely do if it felt that it was given the leeway to do it by the other half of the solution here that Merkel is proposing? What can we expect the European Central Bank to start doing realistically?
Yeah, what it should do already is, first of all, be more concerned with the business cycle. That is just the typical central bank policy of lowering interest rates and signaling that these interest rates will be low over the horizon far beyond the crisis, so that aggregate demand or nominal spending catch up again. And this is the business cycle part, so that, you know, like a lot of problems we have in Europe with the debt crisis comes also from the bad perspective, the low forecast of GDP growth we have.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing the European Central Bank has to do is, if, you know, like you asked me what is likely, is that the central bank steps in and buys the sovereign bonds, so that it increases the prices and in doing so lowers the yields Italy, Greece, and other peripheral mm-hmm. Eurozone countries have to pay on their debt.
Okay, so the first thing, just the lowering of the interest rates, is that a case of the bank using a policy lever that it already uses and is, you know, in other words, exercising a power it's already acknowledged to have and just doing so more aggressively?
You know, with this point, we have the same discussion like in the United States. Mm-hmm. Some people believe that central banks are not able to do a lot, and others, like me, think that central banks can do mm-hmm. much more. And I think what is clear is that the European Central Bank, who actually increased interest rates in the past two times, despite the bad outlooks we have, can do more than the Fed, and at least it should lower rates to the levels of the Federal Reserve.
Okay, so it does have a history of purposefully influencing interest rates. So that would not be a dramatic break with the past if it did that, right? I mean,
no.
It's known to have that. Now, the second part of what you're saying, though, is that when it really directly intervenes on behalf of individual nations that are having trouble selling their debt on the market, right? Is it? Are you talking about it there becoming a lender of last resort?
Yeah. You know, like usually the term lender of last resort was used to describe the relation between the central bank mm-hmm. and the commercial banks within the currency area.
Right.
This time we speak about the European Central Bank becoming a lender of last resort to the sovereigns, that is to the
okay.
member states of the Eurozone.
And that would be new. It does already help out banks, but helping out individual governments would be new. That's the big...
It already does, you know, like the central bank is already doing it, but, you know, as long as it is not signaling that it is unlimited in its support, it will not help. So the big shift will come if the European Central Bank establishes or signals to the markets that it establishes in unlimited swap lines, exchanging its base money for sovereign debt.
So is that almost like saying that there is some interest rate in terms of what, say, Italy has to pay on its bonds? To get somebody to buy them, is that almost like the government, the central bank saying there's some specifying an interest rate that it won't let,
exactly.
It's going to put a ceiling on interest rates because it will step in and buy them if they get higher than a certain or lower than a certain price. But the interest rate
this is a realistic option,
right? So that's what you advocate.
I advocate this step for the core countries, that is France, the Netherlands, and other countries which are clearly solvent, but because of the distress on financial markets and the high level of uncertainty, mm-hmm. have to pay liquidity premium. That is, the interest rates are high not because people expect the countries to default, mm-hmm. but because the financial markets is in distress. But of course, if the interest rates rise, default probabilities increase, and we have this feedback loop, which can be which can lead to a really, really mm-hmm. Heavy crisis. Mm-hmm. But you know, you just said that with the first point, with the interest rate policy, what will be unconventional what has to be done, and what is unconventional for the European Central Bank is that it is not only supposed to lower its interest rates, but to signal that it is it will lower the interest rates over a very long horizon.
Mm-hmm.
That's the crucial matter, to control expectations. Mm-hmm. And if markets believe, if the central bank is credibly committed mm-hmm. to do so, then aggregate demand today will catch mm-hmm. up. And this is what we urgently need in mm-hmm. Europe.
So does this mean that the European Central Bank is already in the business of sometimes printing euros in order to benignly influence lending conditions? And the question is whether it wants to say, we will print as many as are necessary. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, like, of course, it is not actually printing money.
Right, but that's the term used when the Fed here does the comparable thing, right?
Absolutely.
It's increasing the money supply.
Exactly. It has to signal the market that whatever is necessary will be supplied.
Right. Now, and so the idea is that Merkel and Sarkozy are now, they are willing to do that in principle, you think, which you think would really, this kind of policy you think really would solve the problem, right?
Not the entire problem, but it will bring it down to a to a problem that we can actually solve.
Okay, and so it would kind of eliminate the purely psychological part of the crisis, the speculative part of the crisis, and allow them to address the fundamental sources of the original problem.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
So and Merkel is saying, okay, if you know Europe will make this really significant change and subordinate national economic policy to centralized oversight, then we can do this. But that seems to me like kind of a difficult problem, because as I understand it, first of all, you know, if they do it by treaty, it could take forever to actually do, or it could take months, years to actually get that done. And I guess what she's hoping is that at this summit on Friday, you know, enough leaders could show commitment to get this done that then maybe she thinks she could have the political capital to kind of so that the European Central Bank could act if there's some kind of show of commitment to this idea on Friday. Is that what she's looking for?
I think so. You're absolutely right. You know, there is no other rationale for her acting that way, because as you said, treaty changes will take years, and electorates, and not in Germany but in other countries, will be asked to vote for these changes.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, like, she's hoping that the commitment itself will change expectations and lead us to a different kind of equilibrium. The problem is, today it's materializing that other Eurozone countries will not support the plan, not the way it is necessary to have this credible commitment Merkel is asking for. So today, tomorrow, when we have this summit, I think we will see a big disappointment. The indicators shows us this.
Okay. Now, what is, does the European Central Bank really need her approval to do this? I mean, the bank itself is meeting on Thursday, right? Some sort of committee that governs the bank. So why can't it just do it?
First of all, because the governance board is composed of different nations, and there are Germans, and there are other countries which do not agree with what we were talking about, mm-hmm. with the necessity for this aggressive stance. So, I myself am asking me that, and there are many Europeans, especially from the United Kingdom, which push in towards a more aggressive ECB. But that's the way the ECB is designed from the beginning, to be a copy of the German Bundesbank.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it is difficult to change the mentality of a central bank, because they are afraid of losing credibility,
right.
They are afraid of being accounted as a non-independent bank,
mm-hmm.
and I think these are the reasons.
Well, I assume the argument against the bank committing itself to printing as many euros as is necessary to address the debt issue is fear of inflation, right? And I gather is it the case that the inflation would be diffused across Europe broadly so that
No, not at
it
all.
It wouldn't be.
You know, like, we are heading towards a recession. So deflation is not something to worry about in the medium term, which is relevant for the European Central Bank. Most people who speak about inflation have no economic education, I have to say. And, you know, like, this is something we mostly hear in Germany. You know, in other countries, you don't hear that. But there is another issue, the moral hazard issue, you know?
Right.
If the central bank decreases the borrowing costs of other countries, of course the incentive is low in the future to change behavior.
Well, that gets back to the question I was asking, kind of. I mean, yeah, moral hazard refers to the idea that if people make bad economic decisions and the government or somebody bails them out, then that encourages other people to make irresponsible, bad economic decisions in the future if you know you're going to get bailed out. In this case, I gather the bailing out in theory, I gather. I mean, let's assume that you weren't headed in some sort of into a recession right now, or you know, and so this would create inflation. If that were the case, I gather that that cost of that inflation would be distributed across the Eurozone broadly, whereas you know, yes. Right? So the idea is all Europeans are paying for the sins of the Italians. In theory, if it did have an inflationary effect, that would be kind of true, right? That the inflation is spread across Europe, even though the sinners all live in a few countries, right? That's. But what you're saying is that, look, you don't have to worry about inflation right now anyway. But I assume that Merkel faces a German electorate that is saying they don't want to pay for the sins of the Italians and the Spanish, right? That's her big problem.
But the inflation topic is not so much connected with the, you know, like the real problem that Germany faces is going to a transfer union. That is, it is not so much that the cost of bailing them out materializes itself in inflation. It is much more that we have to back the debt of other nations, and this is the moral hazard issue. Like, even if inflation appears, it would be quite healthy. You know, like, I'm usually an inflation hawk, but we are in such a distress that the inflation rate of 4% or 5% would be quite helpful at the moment. You for sure heard the discussion in the United States if the Federal Reserve should switch to a nominal GDP targeting regime, which is exactly the same. Like, if you have a level targeting, then you automatically, in a crisis situation like this, have high inflation expectations. Mm-hmm. And if you have high inflation expectations, you have higher aggregate demand in the present, and this will ease a lot of our debt problem we face today.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is not so much that bailing out introduces inflation and this is a cost, you know. It is more that bailing out leads to future misbehavior.
Right.
And because of this, like, as a German, I don't want to rule over Italy and tell them how to live, but I don't want to adapt their kind of institutions and how they manage their government.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is more the problem.
So in that sense, I mean, if the moral hazard argument is the concern that you'll encourage profligate spending by governments if you bail them out whenever they get into, you know, dig themselves a deep deficit, then there is a kind of logical connection between what Merkel is, you know, what she's demanding in exchange for an aggressive approach by the European Central Bank, right? Because she's saying, you know, she's setting up a mechanism that would neutralize the moral hazard problem in theory, because there would be a systematic penalty exacted on nations that developed a very deep budget deficit, right?
Yeah, but only in theory. It will never work in practice. And if, you know, like, markets don't believe it, it will never work. And the problem is, like, now we are in a crisis situation, and now they are coming up with this plan. The problem is, the markets have to know if they behave according to the speeches today, when the crisis is over once.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not credible given the past of the Growth and Stability Pact we have in Europe, which already implemented some kind of consolidation mechanism, and it was Germany together with France who violated against that, and I think it was broken during all these years 69 times or so.
Yeah.
So it was a lame duck, and, you know, like, talk is cheap. Now they can write everything they want on paper, but we are now breaking all laws and all rules we gave to ourselves. And I don't believe, and I guess the market doesn't believe, that the future post-crisis Europe will commit itself to these new rules.
Yeah.
And there is a different problem. I'm not only an economist, I'm also a citizen. And actually, I am not in favor of the European Commission having all this power and ruling over Greece and over Italy and telling them how to behave and ruling over Germany. Mm-hmm. This is a kind of Europe, you know, like the majority of Europeans wouldn't vote for that, and it will not be sustainable.
Yeah.
So, and it will lead to a situation where we begin to increase sentiments. You know, already today we have the situation that the Greek have increased sentiments towards the Germans because they correctly see that we are forcing upon them these kind of austerity measures, mm-hmm. which make their situation just worse. And at this other side, we Germans see that we are slipping into this transfer union where we have to back the debt of other people.
Right.
And so instead of bringing the electorates together, we are breaking them apart. So, you know, I don't think the Merkel plan will lead to a more peaceful and more integrated Europe, quite the opposite.
So there's already hostility that's been fostered by this between Greece and Germany, and you're saying centralized European control of Greek and other fiscal policy would only heighten the antagonism, you think. At the same time, I mean, she does... It seems to me she's trying to lessen the hostility of Germans toward Greeks, in a sense, with this policy. And, you know, when you said it's not going to convince the financial markets that this long-term policy really will kick in, this centralized monitoring of national economies. But it seems to me maybe she's not trying to convince the financial markets of that. She's trying to convince German voters of that, right, whether or not it turns out to be true, because then she can do the thing that will calm the financial markets, which is unleash the European Central Bank, right? I mean, that's a kind of logic, it seems to me, that okay, granted, this whole thing about centralized oversight of national economies is nonsense, but if the voters will buy it for a year or so, we can at least get this problem solved. And the German voters would have less hostility toward the nations they're bailing out if they, at least for the time being. Does that make sense? No?
It makes a lot of sense. It would be a very indirect approach. And, perhaps this is what she has in mind. The problem is she is the one who is pushing for treaty changes. And if you want to convince your people for 1 or 2 years so that the European Central Bank can be more aggressive, mm-hmm. I think this is a good idea. The problem is you cannot, you know, once you change the treaty, you cannot take it back.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I am not sure if I am willing to pay this price.
But,
you know, I think she should just risk her re-election and just go for it.
But, I mean, there is, in principle, a kind of moral hazard problem here, isn't there? I mean, if it is the case that, again, assuming inflation were a threat, if it is the case that a commitment by the ECB to bail out national economies leads to a situation where the cost of that is diffused across all of Europe and the benefits of it are concentrated on the nations that spent irresponsibly, That is a moral hazard problem, right?
Sure, absolutely. The point is, some countries clearly are punished for not misbehaving. Like think of the Netherlands. You know, Netherlands mm-hmm. is a country mm-hmm. which is clearly solvent, mm-hmm. but you saw recently that even this country has to pay higher interest rates. And if you have such of a liquidity crisis, then there is no moral hazard issue here. The mm-hmm. problem is with Italy and Greece and these countries. And in this case, I propose, but this is an absolute minority view, that the European Central Bank should not act as a lender of last resort, but as an owner of last resort with respect to the banking system. And this boils down to the European Central Bank, the ECB, recapitalizing the banking system in Europe to an extent that we can have heavy haircuts, if necessary, on potentially insolvent countries like Greece and Italy.
So wait, you're talking about taking over the the bank, you're talking about ECB control of the banks in the countries, or
not control of the daily business of banks,
yeah,
but forcing the banks to issue preferred stocks, which are exchanged for central bank money.
Mm-hmm.
And this would serve as a capital buffer, which and once this is in place, and as you know, the central banks can create unlimited amounts of such
mm-hmm.
capital, then we have the situation that if we have haircuts in Italy, for example, which is the third biggest bond market worldwide, then the European banking system could bear this kind of haircut, and then we would not have this kind of contagion and global financial crisis we would surely otherwise have.
Okay.
And this is no moral hazard issue because banks hate it. You know, like because their stock value will crumble,
mm-hmm.
and they are not able to pay out profits, and so dividends come down. So actually, European banks lobby against it.
Okay, so that addresses
against any recapitalization.
Okay, so that addresses scheme. The moral hazard problem at the level of commercial banks, but what about at the level of national governments and their experience?
They have their haircuts, so they suffer.
So,
they have haircuts, and you know, like there are two parties to a contract,
mm-hmm.
the creditor and the debtor. And if we have a haircut, we have the punishment of the creditor. So that the market is more aware of the risk of giving money to these nations. So we would not have this negative bias in the incentive system, which we would otherwise have if the European Central Bank would be just a lender of resort to the insolvent countries.
Okay. I'll have to take your word for that.
No, you shouldn't. You shouldn't. You know, like, I proposed it. I give it some people to read,
yeah.
And you know, like there must be a problem with that because there are much smarter guys than I am, and they didn't come up with it. So I guess there are technicalities which will prove me wrong, and it is of course illegal. I have to say, but any other option is illegal as well. So if you break the law, then perhaps in a sound way.
Yeah, I mean, is that literally true that anything, I mean, even becoming a lender of last resort, is that departing from traditional legal restrictions?
Yeah. The Constitution forbids
such
action.
So what the ECB is contemplating doing now is illegal, and it may just do it anyway.
They are communicating
that right?
They are just doing it to guarantee that the traditional transmission. I hear you.
You still there?
Yeah, I'm still
here. Okay, that's better. We lost contact briefly. So I don't know what the answer was to my question about illegality, but I guess I can watch the tape afterwards and find out.
No, I can repeat it, no problem.
Whether the ECB is
the ECB is just communicating. Yeah, it is just communicating that they undertake these measures, like buying these bonds, not to support these countries, but to guarantee that the transmission mechanism on which they have to rely to implement the traditional monetary policy, that they do this to ensure the stability of this transmission mechanism. So they are, you know, like communicating a way so that lawyers can argue they are not breaking the law.
Okay. Well, that's what lawyers are for.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me ask you, there is this thing you hear a lot, which is that the European Union is either going to have to, or at least the Eurozone, the currency zone within it, is either going to have to become more tightly integrated and more like a single nation almost, in at least some ways, or the thing is going to fall apart. The euro is going to fall apart, and we're going to return to a world of individual national currencies. Do you think that's in some sense true? In other words, does any solution that makes sense to you entail some degree of tighter political integration?
You know, it does not have to be that way, that we only have these two options. As I said before, I think there is a third option, but actually it seems that we are heading into one of these directions, and the European institutions are you know, like they're openly claiming it, that they are using this crisis as a chance to accelerate the integration process. Mm-hmm. And after what, you know, like, if there is a nation which would resist something like this, it would be Germany or so. And since Germany is not resisting to it, and wants these kinds of treaty changes and wants the European Commission to have all these powers, we are actually heading towards this kind of super integrated European Union.
Yeah, and there's just nothing, I guess, comparable in the history, recent modern history of humankind, where you have a considerable degree of governmental integration that encompasses so many nations that speak different languages, right?
I mean, you had a civil war and you had just one language.
Right, right. That's something to keep in mind. And in that regard, I mean, seriously, how do you gauge sentiment at this moment? I mean, you're in Germany and I'm sure you read the newspapers and get a sense of what the sentiment is in Italy and Spain. Is the hostility, you know, on the one hand, you have the resentment in Germany of bailing out nations that some Germans think have been irresponsible and deserve to suffer. And then on the other hand, you have, I guess, in the other nations, resentment at what they see as growing kind of German control of Europe.
Absolutely.
What is the severity of those sentiments right now? I mean, how intense is it getting in Europe?
It is not intense at the moment, I guess. You know, in France, we have next year, I guess, elections, presidential elections, and the socialists are talking about Germany in a way they haven't talked since years, like, the old Germany is rising up. As you know, we have a kind of specific history, mm-hmm. which was not the most benign, if you look at it. And, you know, like, at the beginning of the crisis, we saw pictures of demonstrations in Greece where we had this swastika again. Mm. But you know, that these are minority positions at the moment. Mm-hmm. I am not worried about these sentiments right now. I am more worried about the general sentiments we will have in 20 years. Mm-hmm. You know, like, just think about, you know, like, an American city, a nice suburb where we have neighbors who actually really like each other, and then we implement a mechanism where you have to pay you back the debt of your neighbor. So from one moment to the other, everything your neighbor does is of importance to you.
Right.
You know, like, if he spends more on his car, you know, you're thinking like, hey, what is he doing? I have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure after 10 years, you know, like, these guys hate each other. And you know, like, in Belgium, where I'm living right now, you have the same situation. We have the Flemish parties
right.
want to disintegrate from the from the French-speaking part of the country. Why? If you ask them, one big reason is because they have to pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, we have transfer systems in Germany and many other countries. It works, but it only works if people are, you know, like, seeing each other as an entity. And neither neighbors nor European member states are seeing each other like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is the challenge. Just in closing, one more question. You know, what's been in the news lately is all the problems that have been created by currency unification, by the creation of the euro. There was, of course, initially a rationale for doing it, which was that when you have a lot of nations packed closely together and they're using different currencies, there are costs associated with converting the currencies and with planning, you know, your trade involving different currencies.
Mm-hmm.
And those take a toll. There's an inefficiency generated by that. And the idea was that having one currency would make the whole, would lubricate commerce within that zone and eliminate some of these inefficiencies. And I'm sure some of that did happen. I don't know whether you mm-hmm. supported unification or not, so I'm curious about that. But also about whether you think even given the current problems, you know, it has been worth the benefits that accrued in the meanwhile. What's your view on the wisdom of the euro?
Oh, that's a difficult question. You know, like what you described is absolutely correct, but you described the benefits of such a, mm-hmm. a common currency area. But there are also costs. The cost is that we have parts of this currency area which cannot devaluate if necessary.
Right.
So there is a theory, or there are many theories, which point out that you have some kind, you have to have some kind of optimal currency area, like people moving from Germany to France as easily as they would travel for a job between Connecticut and Massachusetts or something like
right.
this. If they speak the common language, if they have
right.
a common mentality when it comes to the rules of the game, and all these and all that stuff.
Right. So
Europe from the beginning was not like that, and everybody knew that, and it was a political project, and you know, like to appease economists and markets, they implemented the Growth and Stability mm-hmm. Pact, which should ensure that the downside of not having an optimal currency area could be healed by that.
Right.
You know, just to tell you, my internet broke down right now, so, but it is not important, right? I'm recording.
The internet okay. is not essential right now, no.
Okay.
Not
okay.
for us anymore.
I was just worried.
Let me make sure we crystallize that. So in America, when one region falls on hard times, like the Rust Belt in the Midwest, then a number of unemployed workers there can travel to other parts of America and get jobs there. And it's pretty easy to do because they speak the same language. They have, you know, citizenship. You know, it's the same nation. In Europe, it's a little harder because of differences in language and custom and citizenship. And so traditionally, the mechanism had been when one area is having trouble, they could devalue their currency, make their goods cheaper, and increase the demand for their goods. And that's what was taken.
Exactly.
That's what was taken away by the creation of the euro.
In the hope that all these countries will converge over time automatically,
mm-hmm.
which proved wrong.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess that's where we leave it, figuring out, you know, the what's going to happen with this experiment. You seem to be predicting that after this summit meeting on Friday, which I guess may continue into the weekend, the euro will drop in currency markets relative to the dollar. Sounds like. I mean, you think there's not going to be good.
Oh, I never make such kind of predictions.
Okay.
You know, like, I am one of those economists who look at market prices to gain information. I'm usually not predicting how prices will behave.
Okay. But you don't think the news is going to be good for the euro coming out of this summit?
No, we will not have this kind of strong commitment to that is necessary for the Merkel plan
mm-hmm.
to be realized in a beneficial way.
Okay, so the drama will continue and things may get...
Oh, the drama will continue, and it will continue for, I'm sure, for at least a year or so.
Don't we have to reach the actual apocalypse at some point? I mean, you know...
I it can happen anytime, you know, like... Once, you know, like we are in a situation, if spreads hike at one moment and Italy stumbles, you know, like if Italy stumbles,
mm-hmm.
you know, the entire project will either break down or the European Central Bank will step in, which is a probable option.
Yeah.
And then we have just like no talks anymore. We have just the ECB stepping in without Merkel and her great plans.
Well, that would be simpler.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I think we will stumble from one summit to another. I'm not sure how long that will continue.
So you think when we're on the actual brink of the precipice, the European Central Bank will finally step in and establish this new policy precedent of becoming a true lender of last resort?
Yeah, I cannot imagine that they don't do so. It would be just so wrong.
Okay. Well, that's kind of reassuring. And it will provide us a lot of drama in the meanwhile. So thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
All right, I hope we can talk again.
I hope so.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.